All right, well, let's go ahead and get started. Hopefully you have a handout or you're getting a handout as we speak. Again, we're going to cover a lot of information today, kind of like last week, so a handout would probably be helpful for you. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for the time we can spend thinking about your creation. We ask that you'd help us to rightly understand the way you have made things, and to give you the glory that is due your name for your handiwork. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. So we're continuing our discussion on science and the Bible, kind of setting the stage for what we're talking about in the early chapters of Genesis. So again, we're not going to be spending a ton of time in the biblical text today, but I think these are still important foundational things to lay out, because we do live in a day and time where some of the main intellectual challenges to Christianity in our area of the world, in our space and time, involve the issue of creation, evolution, naturalism, things like that. And so just a reminder, we're kind of starting broad in this discussion and funneling down. So last week was very broad. It was kind of more just talking about a philosophy of science. And we spent some time thinking about the big picture of how to understand science. And realize we discussed last time, I'm just going to review real quickly, but we talked about naturalism. You guys remember naturalism? And that's kind of this philosophical idea that presupposes, so beginning the discussion on science, the naturalist brings with them these ideas, namely that only natural causes can be used to describe what we see in the discussion of origins, where we came from, why there's something rather than nothing, how we got to the current state with all the different species that we have in this biosphere, this world that we live in. And so that was kind of the naturalistic, that's the philosophy of naturalism. And remember, science doesn't prove that, right? I mean, there's no test tube experiment you can do to prove the philosophical statement that only what is scientifically measurable is true. That's a philosophical statement. It is not a scientific, empirical, do a test tube experiment and prove it type thing. So everyone brings presuppositions to the table, including the naturalist. And so for naturalists then, the worldview, the lens then that they use is that naturalistic lens, and then the kind of the theory or the filter that they apply in our culture, in our time, is macroevolution. And we talked about that's kind of the idea of from the goo to you via the zoo. And so the idea is that all life came and descended from a common ancestor, a first one-celled creature, and this all happened by natural processes without any sort of intelligence that started it, that guides it. So life comes out of basically nothing, or an eternally existing universe, which most scientists will not argue that anymore because that's actually been disproven, although that was the view around the time of Darwin and others. So, and we talked about a few of the problems with it. So to maybe summarize, this is a quote from Total Truth by Nancy Piercy, and she says this in there. I think this is maybe a helpful summary of last week. It says, Darwinism and design theory. So that's what we're going to look at today, design theory, and this idea that, no, there can be intelligent causes when we talk about origins, okay, where things came from. So Darwinism and design theory are not about different subjects, science versus religion, which is often how the debate gets presented in our culture. Instead, they are competing answers to the same question. How did life arise in the universe? Both theories appeal to scientific data, while at the same time, both have broader philosophical and religious implications. So the point is, we both come with our presuppositions. There's data, and that data has to be interpreted. The question is, who is doing a better job interpreting the data? What best fits with reality? Because that's what we want, is a worldview should correspond with reality. The way you see the world should fit with the way the world really is. And so rather than just saying, oh, we can't even have this discussion because you're talking about religion, we're talking about science, my point is that's not the case. That is not a fair treatment of the issue. We're talking about the same question. Okay, so let me set the scene then for today, what we're going to talk about today, which is evidence for a creator. So this is your Roman numeral one. Science serves to investigate causes. That shouldn't be earth-shattering to you. You know, we use science, we use physics to reconstruct crashes, right? We use science to forensic science for police officers, right? They are using scientific methods, scientific things, measuring things, all this other stuff to help. Can you hear me now? Am I back now? Okay, I don't know what just happened. All right. So forensic scientists, things like that. But I'm kind of getting ahead of myself a little bit. Let me just point this out here. So science, you know, why does this work this way? Chemistry, physics. And then what I was just saying, maybe someone dies. Was it natural causes or was it murder, right? So we kind of have these different things going. So there are three different causes when we talk about scientific investigation, I think. But really, the point is, going back to the presupposition issue, the only two of these are really allowed in our modern scientific way of doing things. But that hasn't always been the case, and I don't think it's fair to make it the case now. So here's the three things. Natural. So think of things like, when you talk about natural causes, you can think of the sand and its smoothness or texturedness at the beach. Okay, the wind and the waves, there are natural things happening that cause the sand to be kind of shaped the way it is, or the sand dunes to be the way they are, right? That's natural causes. The wind did that. The waves did that. Doesn't take intelligence to do that. That's just the way it works. You can think of laws. So laws that operate in our universe. So gravity. Gravity would be an example of a law that is a cause. So something fell to the ground. Science says, why did it fall to the ground? Well, we understand gravitational force. We understand how mass plays into that, and the mass of this, the mass of that, and how gravity is a law that can be explained as a cause. You know, why did that fall? Now, there could also be, you know, well, someone pushed it, but that's still, you know, kind of the same thing. But law, you get the idea. Gravity, certain constants that cause things to happen in a certain way. They're repeatable, they're testable, because it happens the same way over and over again. The third is design and intelligence. So for this, you might compare the Grand Canyon to Mount Rushmore. Is one of those an example of design? Yeah, right? Okay, you guys awake? Which one is an example of design? Mount Rushmore, right? And we know that because we can look at it and there's some complexity there. There's something that's recognizable there. There's something that is very clearly a design versus just natural processes having time and doing all these other things. We can tell the difference. So let's do some more examples here. Natural versus intelligent. Natural. Person dies of a heart attack. Design, murder. Right? And again, is this unscientific? No. The police do it all the time. I'm out again. I'm back in again. Okay, I don't know what's going on. Forensic scientists do this. So I was thinking about this when I was watching the Olympics. You know, you can have like natural snow-covered mountains, backhill, backcountry skiing. You can look at that and say, that's natural, right? I mean, just the snow falls, it makes that puffy snow on the ground. And then you watch the half-pipe events. That's not natural. That's been designed. Now, there can be things that look kind of like a half-pipe, but I mean, these half-pipes are pretty specified. They're pretty specific, and they function to allow people to do certain things specifically, right? Different than backhill snow and skiing. Law versus intelligence. This is an example. It kind of assumes intelligence, so it's not maybe a perfect example, but I think it makes it easy to grasp. A law could be kind of pictured in this way, although this is not necessarily a natural law. This is not what I mean by constant in one sense. But if you design on a computer a macro to run, so you want, like, let's say you're printing happy birthday on wrapping paper, right? And it's just going to say happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday, happy birthday. So you program into the computer every time, you know, put these letters in this order and then just repeat. You get to the end, repeat. You get to the end, repeat. That's kind of an example of a law based system, right? Same thing over and over again. It's repeatable. You could test it and it would always do the same thing. But if you compare that to picking up a book that has text in it, and let's say it's a Shakespeare work, that is not law. That's intelligence. Because there's such complexity there to the words and the letters and the way they were put together. This obviously is not just something that's naturally repeatable. There is no code that you type into your computer that pumps out new Shakespeare plays for you naturally or according to a law that you designed. Now, I mean, you can do simpler things with laws like that macro, right? So that's just a simple example. It's not perfect, I get that, but I just wanted to try to simplify that one a little bit to make it a little easier for us to move on here. You could also think of, gravity might determine where something falls, how it lands. Intelligence will determine where someone sits at a VIP dinner. oh, don't put so-and-so by this person because, you know, they don't get along. These two heads of state won't get along. Don't sit them next to each other. That's intelligence, right? That there was no law that determined this person had to sit next to this person at dinner. So naturalists will often say, well, you can't bring design into the discussion of origins. But remember, again, that's a presupposition. That's not scientifically provable. So that is not based on their own description of the way we can know truth. That doesn't work. It's self-defeating. But also, again, I just point this out one more time. It should be very clear. They do this all the time. Forensic scientists do this. Archaeologists have criteria to be able to determine, was this a as we look here, can we see that tools were used by human beings to design these things? Or was this just, rain and wind pushing away at this rock? Did someone carve this? Or did you see what I'm saying? That we do this in archaeology. Cryptologists do this when they're trying to crack codes and stuff. Is this actually random letters and numbers? Or they have certain rules they can look at to say, okay, does this actually fit something that would have been produced by intelligence? There was a design to what this code is. So we want to then ask the question, as we look at evidences in this world, do we see design as being a possible cause and origin for the origin of life and the universe and all these other things, or do we see that that can be explained simply and only by naturalistic processes, law and natural forces, right? Okay, so we're all on the same page so far, and this is a lot, but hopefully it's helping you. Okay. So we're going to look at evidence for design today, and because again, if just showing the problems with macroevolution, just showing the problems with the naturalistic worldview, which we did some of that last week, you'll remember that, we talked about some issues. We ended by talking about the problems with ethics, but there were some other things we talked about. But I don't want to just do that. We also want to show a positive presentation of, okay, so how can we look at the data and see evidence for design? And so that's what we're doing today in our time together. So we're going to look at two main areas of argument, and one can be called the cosmological argument, and the other could be called the teleological argument. So cosmological is really arguments from cause and effect. Every cause or every effect has a cause. That's where we're going to argue there. And then the teleological is from design, the idea that things that have goals. In other words, like your coffee mug, there's a goal for the design of a coffee mug. So that tells you there's design to it. It's perfectly made to hold your coffee, right? So that's kind of where we're going to go. And we're going to have a couple lines of thought under the teleological thing. So let's spend some time thinking about it. And by the way, there are a lot of other evidences that we could go into in this area, and we just can't go into all of them. So I'm just trying to stick to kind of two main areas this morning. So let's talk about the cosmological argument, this argument from cause and effect. So there are multiple forms of this argument again. So I'm going to give you a simple version of it, but there are other ones. Maybe have you heard of the Kalam argument? K-L-A-M. Okay, so that's not the one we're going to talk about, but that can be something we could add into this and make it a more complex argument. But we're just going to focus on the basic syllogism. So a syllogism is just a logical, it's got premises and then a conclusion that follows, right? And if the premises are true, then generally speaking, your conclusion is true, right? If you hadn't had any logical fallacies up here and then making your connection to down here, then everything flows and that works. So the logical argument is basically this. Everything, see this on your handout, everything that had a beginning had a cause. The universe had a beginning. Therefore, the universe had a cause. And we can even add in there an intelligent cause, and we'll see more of that when we get to the teleological argument, that these two kind of fit together. So let's talk about this a little bit. Let's talk about some scientific evidence for the idea that the universe had a beginning. And by the way, everything having a beginning is, I think, pretty obvious. When someone, you hear something go bang, you generally ask, well, what made that noise? And if someone just gave you an answer, nothing. I mean, that won't fly, right? I mean, if there's an effect, there's that sound, there was a cause. Now, you might tell me you don't know what the cause was, and that's fine, but don't tell me it was nothing. There was a cause, right? If I hear my kids, all of a sudden they're screaming coming out of there, what went on? Oh, nothing. Well, no, there's a cause for the screaming. What happened, right? This effect had a cause. So let's talk about evidence for the fact that the universe had a beginning. The expanding universe would be the first thing. So we have Einstein's theory of general relativity in 1915. By the way, Einstein was quite shocked by this theory of relativity. Because one of the things that it showed was that there had to be a beginning to the universe. And Einstein didn't like that initially. So in his initial formulas, he added a fudge factor in his mathematical calculations, which later on was shown to not be accurate. And even he himself said, yeah, I kind of did that because I didn't really like where things were going. And we have, because prior to that, there was this idea that we could just say we had a static universe. In other words, there's no expansion going on. It's just static. It is the way it is, which then was really what a lot of scientists would cling to and say, see, the universe didn't have a beginning. It just always existed. So we don't have to explain where origins came from. We just have to explain how life evolved. But that didn't really work out. You have Alexander Friedman, a Russian mathematician, along with a Belgian astronomer named George Lemaitre. I don't know. I shouldn't announce for the Olympics. I wouldn't get any of those guys' names right. And they were able to predict using Einstein's theory and other things that the universe is in fact steadily expanding. That was in the 1920s. Hoyle coins the term the Big Bang theory, which is the idea that there was a moment where everything exploded from one point and began the spread of the universe. 1929, Edwin Hubble discovered that light coming from distant galaxies appeared to be redder in color than it should be. And if you know about light, light has these wavelengths, right? And the different wavelengths and things affect, that's what gives you the different colors of light. And so again, I'm not a scientist, right? I just enjoy science, but I'm not a scientist. So I'm not going to sit here and try to explain everything because I'm not going to pretend like I know how it all works. But scientists say that this redder color shows that these things are actually moving away from us. And you might think of it in terms of sound. We have the Doppler effect, right? That kind of tells us we can hear sound like a siren coming towards us and then going past us, and the sound waves change and things like that. This is not an exact correspondence, but maybe that just helps you kind of solidify in your mind what we're talking about. The red shift in the light, the fact that it's on the red end of the spectrum, tells us this light is not just stationary. These things are actually moving away from us. And so that was the red shift there. Other evidence, such as the temperature of the universe's background radiation, again, I'm not a scientist, but the measures that they took on that fit with the idea that there would have been one initial starting point based on the temperature that we find in the background of the universe. So there's some other data there. But my point is that's all pointing to the fact that it's expanding out, which has the idea that it had a beginning. If it's expanding out from, it's got to expand from something. It can't infinitely expand from nothing. There had to be something from which it started. Another thing that fits with this idea is the second law of thermodynamics, which says a lot of different things are included in that idea. Thermodynamics is the study of matter and energy. And part of what it tells us and what we see in the universe is that the universe is using energy. In other words, it's kind of like you have a flashlight. You turn it on at night. Let's say you leave it on all night. You wake up. Is the light as bright as it was at first? No, because it's using the energy that it has, right? It's using the energy from those batteries. And so that's what we find in the universe, this entropy. Things are kind of falling off. Energy is being used. And so one of the things I think this implies and points to is there had to be a beginning, because you can't infinitely lose this energy. If we're still losing energy, that means we still have it. That means it started at some point. It has not always been there. So it's kind of like the idea of a clock is running down. Someone had to have started that clock. So a lot of this is just logic. So the universe has a beginning, and whatever begins had a cause. This is a quote from an atheist named Kai Nielsen, who said, suppose you suddenly hear a bang, and you ask me what made that bang, and I reply, nothing, it just happened. You would not accept that. So again, the point is, if we have the effect of there is a universe, then we should be able to reason back and say, there has to be a cause for this. If it hasn't eternally existed, there has to be some sort of cause for it. Okay? So the question is, what or who began it? And the naturalist, having a closed system, a closed universe, they just have their box and nothing else comes in and out of that box when they're interpreting stuff, they are not looking for the universe to be doing what scientists are saying it's doing, which is it had a beginning, it's expanding. Let me give you a few examples to show this is not what scientists wanted to find. Carl Sagan, you guys familiar? Anyone watch Carl Sagan's show back in the, I think it was the 80s, right? Cosmos or something. He was like the scientist. Hopefully you didn't really waste too much time watching it, but maybe some, right? But So at the beginning, this is how his shows would begin. He would say, the cosmos is all that is or was or ever will be. I mean, that's God-like language, but what's being deified? It's the universe, right? And this idea that it's always existed. That's what he's saying in that quote. It has always existed. There are some other quotes we could go through, but I won't for the sake of time. So I know this is somewhat academic, but one more academic thing that I do not have enough knowledge to speak to, but I read some folks who have more knowledge than I do. If you're familiar with quantum mechanics, this is at times being used now to argue things can spontaneously arise out of nothing, and we can't necessarily predict where some of the most basic parts of matter are going to be, how they're going to appear. There are a couple problems with that, and one is that it confuses causality with predictability. So they're saying we can't predict where these little parts of these molecules or atoms and things are going to end up at, therefore they don't have a cause. Well, that's not necessarily true, right? I mean, that's probability, saying we can't give a probability to where this is going to pop up when we measure it, versus saying just then reasoning and saying, oh, well, we have no idea, it just comes out of nothing. That's you haven't proven that yet. And additionally, even there's questions about as we measure these smallest of things we can measure, are we not also affecting actually where they show up as we measure them? That's been proposed as well. My point is I don't think we know enough in that area to make some sort of argument based on quantum mechanics. And as William Lane Craig says, when you leave for work, you don't worry that a horse is going to spontaneously appear in your living room and tear up your carpet while you're gone. It's kind of the same thing. I don't think we're going to be thinking even at the smallest level that things just are going to magically appear. But again, I'm not a scientist, so I can't say anything more on quantum mechanics. I have some resources I could give you if you want to read more. So my point is, scientists then they're not the ones that have a naturalistic worldview are not going after. They don't want this necessarily to be the case. It doesn't necessarily fit what their view has been. It seems to fit the Bible pretty well. Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The heavens and the earth didn't exist. Boom, God creates them. They exist, right? Hebrews 11:3. By faith, we understand that the universe was created by the word of God, so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. So God created what is visible out of his own power. He is the one who's existed eternally, not his material universe. I think we see that in Hebrews 11. Okay, so now let's move to the second main area here, the teleological argument. Design points to a designer. Anyone familiar with the watchmaker illustration from William Paley? You're familiar with it? A few people are? Okay. So this is kind of some logical, a logical point here first before we look at a few pieces of evidence. William Paley said, look, if you were walking up a mountain hill and you found a watch, this is back in the day, this is not your Apple Watch, although the same idea would apply, but we're just going to stick with an old-fashioned watch for now. You find this old-fashioned stopwatch or clock, you know, like little pocket watch thing, and it's sitting up there. As you look at it, you realize that it's actually perfectly designed to do something, which is to tell time, right? It's got these it's got a spring that gives it motion. So again, I'm talking about an old-fashioned one. Don't take apart your Apple Watch and try to figure this out. It's different. It has a spring, and you'd probably void your warranty. It has a spring to give it motion. It has a series of wheels that transmit that motion into different directions to get it to turn the face of the clock the way it needs to turn it. The wheels you find are made of brass that don't rust, so that seems to be a good design to make it last for a while. The spring is made of steel because of the resilience of that metal, and the front has a glass cover so that you can see through it and actually see what's happening on the face of this clock. So then the question is, if you find that, do you assume it's a product of naturalistic forces or just laws of, you know, the way things work, like gravity, or do you assume a designer designed it? In other words, it was made with a purpose, a goal, therefore it was designed for that. There was intelligence that put that together. And I think the answer is probably pretty obvious, right? We would assume that a watch has a watchmaker. Watches don't just come from natural forces in the universe. You should, you know, walking along the beach collecting seashells, you're not going to find a naturally developed watch on the shore. It's not going to happen. So The world, which shows even greater evidence of design, should and even more complex design, should point us to the fact that there is an intelligent designer to this universe and this world. Okay, so that's kind of the logical argument that's going on there. And by the way, I mean, I don't know if you guys watch, I sometimes enjoy watching those nature shows. You know, BBC puts some stuff out, and like Planet Earth, I think is what it was called. I didn't watch all of them, but I watched some of them. But man, when you watch those things, they just cannot help resorting to language of design, engineering, nature's intelligence, because it's impossible to describe it any other way when they see these things that are just incredible and stunning in nature. And so this is kind of an example of how some scientists speak of it who have a naturalistic worldview. This is an example from George Simpson. He's a scientist with a naturalistic worldview. He says, "A telescope, a telephone, or a typewriter is a complex mechanism serving a particular function," right? It serves a particular function. They do certain things. They have a design. They have an end goal in mind. "Obviously, its manufacturer," so intelligence, "had a purpose in mind, and the machine was designed and built in order to serve that purpose. An eye and an ear or a hand is also a complex mechanism serving a particular function. It, too, looks as if it had been made for a purpose. This appearance of purposefulness is pervading in nature." Then he goes on to say, but don't worry about it, because natural selection explains this apparent purposefulness. But, I mean, what is natural selection is really, it's kind of a little bit redundant, actually, because it's the idea that what's natural will happen. What's selected naturally will naturally happen. I mean, it's a little bit of a redundant statement, but the idea is just, if an animal is stronger, it's probably more likely to survive. Okay, well, that doesn't really answer the question that we're talking about, though. That doesn't explain why there's design. That's not. I mean, say if you argued that about the watch, I mean, you'd look at someone and be like, "You're crazy. What do you mean natural selection is not an answer to this question, right?" But my point is no matter which worldview you come from, at this point, if we're honest, I think we have to say there is design in this universe. There is at least apparent design in the universe, even if we're going to explain it a different way. And so then the question is, does the naturalistic worldview, or does one that brings in the idea that intelligent causes are true and valid, which one of those better explains that? Okay, so let's keep moving in this teleological section here, this design. Evidence from the cell or biochemistry. Anyone heard of irreducible complexity? You guys heard of this? Michael Behe wrote a book, Darwin's Black Box. Anyone familiar with this? I actually haven't read the book, but okay. Some of you are, some of you aren't, some of you are asleep. So it's a little bit of a newer argument. This is what Darwin wrote in The Origin of the Species. He said, "If it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed," so when he talks about that, I mean, you could think of like your eye or something like that, right? Or even really, now that we know it, a one-celled bacteria is pretty complex. "Any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, then my theory would absolutely break down." So Darwin's theory for him at the time, they didn't know what cells were made of. They didn't know the small micro-level stuff. But he was looking at the big picture macro stuff, and he's saying, look, I mean, this bone structure kind of looks like this bone structure. This skull looks like, why couldn't it be that this one just kind of gradually over time became bigger and became like this? I mean, kind of like a pile of sand. Can a pile of sand get bigger gradually over time? Yeah, it can, right? I mean, if you just keep adding grains of sand, it'll keep getting bigger and bigger. But if there's something that is so complex that it's not like a grain of sand, but it's more like a computer, with all these parts that if you don't have all the parts, the computer isn't turning on. Well, if you have that, then you've got a problem for macroevolution. And so Michael Behe, who's a biochemist, started out with a Roman Catholic upbringing. And in his schooling, he was very much steeped in macroevolutionary theory. So he has, so even though he's a Roman Catholic, he really had no... reason to just outright reject evolution as a possibility. He kind of grew up just thinking that was the way it was. But as he studied the cells and it's at the molecular level and what makes them function, how they work, it just got to the point where this this doesn't work with macroevolution. Darwin, what Darwin said is in fact the case. When he said, if something could be this complex, well, it is that complex. So he talked about how each cell is kind of like a mini factory town. So each cell, I mean, think about it, this is not just your body as a whole, this is each cell in your body, each cell in a bacteria, the most simplistic living organisms we have, each cell is kind of like a mini factory town. They have power plants, assembly lines, recycling centers, a transit system, which has to have timing so that different packages don't hit each other within the cell as they go from one place to another. External controls to keep things in, to let things out. They have gates, pumps, identification markers, kind of like, let me see your badge so you can get in here, that type of stuff. A library of information and blueprints, think of DNA. Francis Crick, one of the co-discoverers of the structure of DNA, said, nature invented the assembly line some billions of years before Henry Ford. I might disagree with the timing on that, but the point is, even he's going to say that this is an assembly, this is engineering stuff, is what we're talking about, right? And in fact, that's the way a lot of this molecular chemistry and biology stuff is talked about now, is in terms of engineering. They reverse engineer things to figure out how they work, because it's basically engineered type stuff. So you have this very coordinated, interwoven parts that only work after all the parts are in place. And which means that it can't work if you just have some of it and not all of it. Slight changes are not going to work in this case, is the point. So, and to illustrate that, Behe uses this illustration. This is, I think, a helpful illustration. He talks about a mouse trap. Okay, so a mouse trap has several parts to it. Okay, so if you were to think about it in terms of macroevolution, the idea would kind of be you should be able to add, through mutation and over lots of time, some things mutate, they change, and they stick around when they're shown to be useful. And if they're not, maybe they die off, that type of stuff, right? Well, so if you're going to take that illustration on a mouse trap, then what you have to be saying is, okay, if I just have the piece of wood on the mousetrap, let's say there's four parts to a mousetrap. Let's say I just have one piece, I just have the wood. Does that just mean I'm going to catch a quarter of the mice versus 100% of the mice? How many mice am I going to catch? Zero. So is that a useful adaptation? Absolutely not. And if you're talking hundreds of thousands, millions of years, that something has to stick around, that doesn't work. Right? If I have two parts, let's say I have the wood and I've got the little clamp thing that smushes the mouse, how many mice am I going to catch? 50%? Zero. Let's say I have three of the four parts, right? Am I going to catch 75%? No, I'm going to catch zero. The point is, this is an example of something you have to have all the parts right from the beginning for it to do what it needs to do. And if that was a living organism, it would not survive with just one, two, or three of those parts. It would need all those parts to survive. Otherwise, it's dead and you don't have anything to evolve. So all the parts have to be in place simultaneously. And arguing that there's like scaffolding that was built in that helped it survive until the next piece came along, that doesn't work either because you still have complexity there. How are both those things there at the same time? It's the same question. Okay, so another example. So that's one thing. Another example in this area could be the anthropic principle, which is the idea that the world is very fine-tuned to support life. So you can think of all the things, if you think about it this way, think of it like there's a universe machine and there's all these different knobs. You have gravitational force, you have the temperature variation, you have the axis of the earth, its distance from the sun, you have all the planet you're talking, you have all these different things. You could turn one way or another to all these different numbers, okay? It happens to be that it's such that all these things perfectly work so that biological life can exist on planet Earth. Now, I'm not saying this just completely proves the case, but I think it's pretty strong evidence that supports this idea. So example, our distance from the sun. If we were closer, it'd be too hot. If we were farther away, we'd be too cold. The makeup of H2O, it's a solvent. It's able to function as a solvent. It expands when it freezes. If it didn't expand when it freezes, we'd have some problems. You'd have ice all over the bottom of lakes and things, killing off all the life that could live in the pond even through the winter. And that's not going to work for life in those areas. Surface tension of water, the ratios of atmospheric gases. If oxygen levels were even probably a few percentage points. I think one place I read said if they were 4 percentage points higher than what oxygen is in our atmosphere, fires would erupt. If they were 15% less or down 10%, we would suffocate. The axis of the Earth affecting temperature, gravity, if it was slightly stronger, all the stars would they would collapse in on themselves. If it was weaker, all the stars would expand to the point where you wouldn't have any heat generated from stars like our sun. Dr. Collins, the other co-discoverer of DNA, he seemed to be, at least have a Christian worldview. Crick did not, the guy who said it seems like we have a factory assembly line. But this guy seemed to be a Christian. But here's what he said. We have caught the first glimpses of our instruction book, previously known only to God. And I think that goes back to the DNA idea, but I think you see the same thing happening in all these specific things that happen. Someone has turned all these dials to where they need to be. Seems like that took some intelligence. Now, the responses can be, well, there's been, how do we know there hasn't been billions of different universes and this one just happened to work out? But there are responses to those. We just don't have time to talk about all those right now. Okay, let's talk about DNA. Oh, I kind of did jump ahead of myself. That last quote was under my section of DNA. So let's talk about DNA real quick, and then we'll finish up here. So DNA has these four bases. You can think of it as an alphabet, right? And from those four letters, they can combine in different orders and different ways to basically tell this is what needs to happen. This is what the cell is going to do. This is how we're going to operate. It's kind of like software on a computer in some ways, right? And so what we find is now that we know more about DNA, it really is a science of information. Information technology is being applied to understanding DNA because that is what it is. It's information. Dawkins, who is an atheist, wrote, "The genetic code is truly digital in exactly the same sense as computer codes. This is not some vague analogy. It is the literal truth." And so his point is, this is information within the DNA, and it's very specified information, very complex information. And so in ordinary life, when we see a set of specific, complex information, do we assume natural causes made that? So for example, you're walking down the beach and you see, it's Valentine's Day, you see a nice heart on the shore and it says, you know, Bobby loves Ruth. I mean, do you see that and do you think, man, wind and the waves are doing some crazy stuff today. That just kind of naturally came out. And you know, you see a couple walking down ahead of you and they have they're holding hands, right? And you're thinking, man, the waves and wind just really made this weird shape here, these letters, and spells out, you know, this person loves that person. Or would you more naturally assume, seems like someone with intelligence put these letters together, put this shape together to communicate something. I mean, intelligence is behind that, right? DNA is the same way. It is information that communicates something, right? And this implies design. This implies a communicator. And we can pick this out scientifically too. It's not, I mean, even like with the hieroglyphic stuff, remember they found this, all these hieroglyphics, they couldn't interpret them, but they knew it was a language when they first found it. Then the Rosetta Stone comes along and they can finally just decipher what it says because now they have the code that they need to understand what it's saying. But they weren't confused at the beginning when they first saw it. They knew that highly specified order of things and the specific nuances of that said language, intelligence, someone with intelligence made this. Rather than, again, you look and you see some kind of scratches down the side of a rock that appear to be from water dripping constantly down it, and you say, okay, that's a natural cause. It's not that hard to figure out. So the counterargument is, well, natural causes. If you give enough time, you give enough natural forces, these things can happen. But think of a Scrabble game. So you might say, okay, blindfold yourself and start picking out letters. Is it true that you might eventually spell something like it or can? You might, but if you keep messing with those tablets, guess what? You're going to undo what you just spelled eventually, which is a problem for natural selection and macroevolution because their kind of idea is, no, it just sticks. It never can get changed. But it also, even if that's true, DNA, okay, so in DNA, you have at least in some of the most basic DNA we have, you have at least 30 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica, that much information in one strand of DNA. And it all communicates something. It spells something. It's like a volume of these 30 volumes of books with all this specified, specific, understandable information in it. Try doing that with a Scrabble board blindfolded. That's not going to happen. It won't. So again, the idea is intelligence better explains DNA and the information that we have in DNA. Natural laws can account for it. Could be the other argument. That actually doesn't work when you look at the combination of the way it goes together. Again, it's kind of like comparing this, you know, this macro printed birthday paper to Shakespeare's Hamlet or something. DNA is like Shakespeare's Hamlet. There's not a bunch of rules you can put in place that's going to produce Shakespeare's writing, his play, Hamlet. Even though maybe you can get Happy Birthday to print out over and over again. One is way more complex, way more specified. So we can't confuse natural and law-type things with what we have in DNA. It just doesn't work. Okay, so let's bring this thing to a close here. I know it's been a lot of information, and if it's been unclear to you, I think last week I had some books that I recommended at the end of that. If you want some books because you want to read it to get more in-depth or because I was a little confusing, which I'm sure I am, you can read some good books where people have thought a lot more about these topics, and I can recommend those to you. One of them I really have enjoyed is Nancy Piercy's book, Total Truth. Specifically, chapters 5 through 8 are really helpful on this topic. I Don't Have Enough Faith to Be an Atheist by Geisler and Turk. Lee Strobel's The Case for a Creator. There were a few others, I think. But let's bring this to a close. So Darwinism and design theory are not about two separate things. They are discussing the same question. And really, the thing we're dealing with is, can there be intelligent causation in the world and in the universe? Is that a legitimate potential explanation for the data, if it fits the data? This is different than just saying, well, we have no idea, so it must be God who did it. And we're looking at hard and fast data. And I'm trying to show you, the data, is it better explained by intelligence, or is it better explained by just sheer natural processes and laws? I think intelligence is the better explainer of the effects that we see. So this isn't just, oh, we have no idea. God must have done it. That's just our answer for everything. We don't know. That's not what we're saying here. We're saying, look at the data, and then if you don't, right out of the gate, rule out the possibility of intelligent design or an intelligent creator, then it seems to me like that fits better. Now, I get it if you right out of the gate say, nope, we cannot, that is not science to let intelligence be a potential cause. Well, really, you've undermined what science does, first of all, because we do that all the time in other areas of science. But also, then you've stacked the deck, and it's not really a fair discussion at that point. We need to look at the data and see whose worldview better interprets it. So hopefully that's helped you. And we still have some discussion to have, though, and that's what's going to happen next week, on the question of how did God create, if we're saying God created. At what tempo? Was it fast, short period of time, or was it slow, long period of time in which he created? Was it long ago in the very distant past, or was it in the not-so-distant past? And so Doug's going to talk about that next time. It's really more of a maybe intramural debate among Christians, and we're going to look more at Genesis and other places in the Bible to see why we, as the teachers in this church, hold to the view that this world is relatively young, and it was created, as we read Genesis, in a literal short 6-day period. And so we can look at that next week. So let me pray for us. Father, thank you for this time in your word, or really just thinking about your creation. And we are just in awe as we think of the design, as we think of the intelligence that points us to your handiwork, as we see in Psalm 19. All creation points to you. It is your handiwork. It pours forth speech that you are the creator, the wise, great, powerful creator who has made all things, who has eternally existed and has made us. And so we thank you and praise you. In Jesus' name, amen.